Brigadier Calva Trail 6.
The cookhouse was over the stream, and mat shed roofing was put there to disperse the smoke from cooking so it couldn't be noticed from the air. Then finally, there were the further down the bottom of the stream, or further down the stream, were the latrines, which were poised over the stream, so you had the feces was dispersed downstream. I mentioned this because one of my suggestions for how to find guerrilla camps was to put a chemist down the bottom of the stream and try and trace the manure and the feces and the bits of cooking at the bottom of the stream and then trace it upwards. My idea for destruction of these camps was to, rather like a surgeon, he examines the whole body, you find out where the camp is likely to be, then you trace through the rivers, you then by infrared you can trace the density of the jungle, and then you can also trace what is uncommon and unnatural to the jungle, like metal. And with all these things you could make the probability of where a camp should be.
Did these methods work?
They were never used. I never managed to sell this to anybody, either in London or there. Yet at the same time, I think I told you that I went out on patrol with a number of different regiments, and I also went with the police and with the Malays, and I went with the Navy and also the RAF. Now, in the RAF, they had plenty of bombs available, and they used to drop up to 50 or 100,000 pound bombs onto guerrillas. It was just purely hit or miss. And a lot of it was done onto Aborigine huts. It wasn't onto guerrillas at all. I went on one of these raids, and they got lost. These were 100 squadron. They, of Lancasters, I think they were. And we went off very early in the morning. And then they went over the target, and there was 10 tenths cloud. And they wandered around. Then they went up higher. Then they were flying in close formation, and we went into a cumulonimbus cloud, and which caused terrific thing, and we sort of shot out of it at about 30,000 feet and were dispersed all over Malaya, and the squadron leader had to go around and gather everybody again to get into formation. Well, then there was a Dakota supposed to be spotting for us, and he found a gap in the clouds, and so we went over there and we did a dummy run, and I knew Malaya by now. I'd flown all over it and walked over a lot of it, and I knew it wasn't the right place. So they were just about to drop 100,000 pound bombs in the wrong area. Then they went off again. It was peacetime, so they couldn't land with their aircraft bombed up. And so they looked around for a place to drop their bombs, and they went over the Malacca Straits and tried to get permission to drop their bombs in the water. But then the high command was worried that they might drop it on board a ship, and so we were called back again. And finally, the weather cleared more, and the Dakota had found the right target, and we went over in formation and dropped the bomb, at least tried to. There were about seven aircraft, and I was watching the other ones go over, and the squadron leader telling me it's a lovely sight. And then the bomb aimer said, only one bomb gone, the rest are stuck up. And so he sent the rest of the force away, whilst we went round and round and manually levered the bomb out until we'd got rid of our 14,000 pound bombs, whatever they were. And the whole aircraft was sweating because it was a very dodgy time. And eventually we got back. On the ground, the idea where we were bombing was guerrillas are supposed to be there, and they surrounded the area with a battalion of Gurkhas, a Malay battalion, and a British battalion. And the idea was to bomb in the centre and drive the guerrillas out where the infantry would pick them off. But in actual fact, it didn't work, most unlikely to work. And some of the bombs dropped in the Gurkha area. Didn't kill any of them, but gave them a good fright. So I'm telling you this because this was in early days, and they were trying to find out. It was just like in Vietnam. We had weapons, but they weren't adapted to guerrilla warfare and jungle warfare. And my idea of operating on the ground was done. But that's one reason I tried to work out a small scientific method where somebody could tell approximately where these deep camps were. Then the chief of police and others said there were no deep camps. Well, we found out later that they were there. And it is in the whole history of guerrilla warfare, you have to have your areas where you can train and resuscitate and do this, that, and the other. So, anyway, I put my troops in. They didn't achieve anything because they had to get to know the country. And the jungle looks like a lot of trees if you fly over it on the top. But in actual fact, it takes shape in your mind. There are easy paths which go along the ridges. There are other paths which meet together to cross swampy area. And if you've been in an area 20, 30, or say 30 miles by 30 miles, for a few weeks, it takes shape. And then you can know where to put your ambushes. You put them just at the one crossing of a swamp or along ridges or this, that, and the other. And they started to have results, but as soon as we started to have results, there was pressure put on us to go somewhere else, and then we were moved somewhere else. And then we were moved onto the rivers. And they didn't realize, there again, I probably should have seen General Harding, that a counterinsurgency force should be left in an area to get to know it and to make friends with the Aborigines. Now, one of the things I instituted, like I had done with the Chindits, I had some doctors with me, and their job was to heal the Aborigines of any diseases they had and so win them over. It's like boy's own paper thing. If you cure the headman's son, the whole tribe comes to your side. And we did this, and the most common complaint they had was yaws, you know, W-A-W-S, which can be very quickly cleaned up by penicillin. It was sort of miraculously. And so in the first area we operated on, we did this. But they'd sent me the wrong medical officer, who wasn't physically strong, and who was going to be looking after women and childbirth.
Gynecologist.
And he wasn't the person required. So I remember sending a message to the director of medical services, can I have two second row rugby forwards types of doctors, possibly from St. Mary's. And he sent me two massive young men who were very, very good and were good for morale for everybody, and they were enormously strong. And I remember seeing them with some of these negritos, about three negritos under their arms, taking them along to cure them. And they were a great success. There was rivalry. People all the time asking us to provide results. At the same time, saying, what can these people do which we can't do? Well, the main thing was we could go into the deep jungle and stay there. And on the whole, my troops stayed in the jungle for 3 months at a time. Now, one other thing I did, which is purely my own idea, was the use of balloons. Now, you know that type of light lamp which works on hydrogen sulfide, is it? Sulfurate of hydrogen is a pressure lamp which grows. And all it is you just pour water in, and it breaks up the oxygen from the hydrogen. The hydrogen is inflammable, and it gives you a light.
Is it called a carbide?
Carbide lamp. And so what we brought in was some carbide lamps, but instead of lighting the thing, we used the hydrogen to blow up balloons. So this was very light. You just had to have some carbide, and you could blow up a balloon which would find its way through the trees. And if you had different coloured balloons, you could put this thing on a string, and it would go up above the trees, and very, very easily seen by a light aircraft or something. And you could identify yourself if you had somebody wounded, or you could identify the enemy and so on. And it was very successful. I understand they were adopted later on, although some people try to ridicule them. They were invaluable.
Each colour of balloon represented a specific thing.
Yes, that's right, yes. And you could say on your radio. On the radio thing, again, I had to teach them. They'd forgotten, the people from Europe, that in the jungle you could not get ground waves, as you couldn't use rod aerials. You had to use wire aerials, and they had to be directional aerials, and they had to be really ideally from high ground, top of a hill or something like that, and then you could communicate easily. But and again, I used the Tyndall method, where we sent all our messages back to base, and then they were retransmitted out to other people. So you didn't try to signal direct. Our signal system was very good. It was what I asked for. I think it was broken up later, after I'd left. The other things on equipment, I was asked all that. We had hammocks, which were a new introduction for IDEAL. We got American carbines, which again were spread throughout the rest of the forces, And I adopted also all the other methods we'd learnt in Burma, which had all been forgotten, such as everything was car key, the backs of maps were car key, so they didn't, because normal people give themselves away by holding a map up in the air. Instead of waiting till people had got skin diseases and then painting them with gentian violet, I insisted that our doctors painted everybody with gentian violet before they went into the jungle. And this had a big effect in preventing jungle sores. As you can see, what I'm telling you is all methods. I think this is important because these methods remained in the SAS and they spread throughout the army and were used to very great effect later on in Borneo, where my first adjutant, John Woodhouse, later commanded the SAS, and the commander of the Rhodesian SAS, whom I also had to train, and I'm going to forget his surname at the moment, it's Peter, some name like Wills or Mills, he became the Rhodesian commander-in-chief, and I met him when I went to Rhodesia. And a lot of the people whom I trained went right to the top in the SAS and elsewhere.
When you say Borneo, you mean the confrontation with Indonesia?
Yes, that's right, yes. Remember, this is all before a Templar had come out. I was very, thanks to now Sir Robert Thompson, who was who had been with me in both Wingate operations, and who, after the war, had been put in charge of the Chinese in Malaya, I forget the actual title, and then he'd been made Defence Secretary in Malaya, and I used to see him a lot, and a lot of what I wrote in my report was from him. He was much more diplomatic than possibly I was, and he managed to do a lot for the Chinese without upsetting the Malays too much. But you must remember, and it is to this very day, I report it, when the Malays, as a dominant race, have now put 91 Chinese under arrest because they're afraid of Malay and Chinese riots and revolts. It's an endemic thing there. The Chinese are the cleverest and best at all types of business and so on like that. And the Malays are trying to hang on to their country. The Malay regiment all suffered from hookworm, which has a debilitating effect. And they put in a policy of deworming the Malays, and this increased their efficiency tremendously. It's these debilitating diseases like endemic malaria, hookworm, amoebiasis due to amoebic dysentery, amoebiasis, A-M-O-E, I don't know how to spell it, biases, which made the Malays sort of lethargic and that much drive. I may mention the fact when I came out of Malaya, I went to the RAMC hospital in Millbank, and they found out I had hookworm amoebiasis and two forms of malaria. So that was one of the effects. Now I will give you a article I wrote which says the type of operations we did in Malaya, and we were accused of not causing any casualties. In actual fact, we did cause a lot of casualties to the guerrillas, but you couldn't count heads. One method I used, which was frowned upon, I converted ordinary 303 bullets, took out the cordite, and put in plastic explosives and a detonator, and then sealed it up again. And then we either sold it or left it for the guerrillas to pick up. And the effect of this is when you fired your rifle, it blew your face in. I asked for a little workshop, and we made, I told them how to make, we took the fuse out of a Mills bomb and put instantaneous fuse instead, so that when you threw the grenade, it blew yourself up. Thirdly, we made rifles. You took the stock off and you put in a ratchet, so that after using the rifle for a few times, it tripped up a fuse, and inside the butt of the rifle would be an explosive, and so you kill the chap firing the rifle, but you could fire a few rounds first.
How effective do you think these methods were?
The Mills grenade and the other ones were, and the bullets were the most effective, but what the British Army felt, my God, he said, they'll use them against us. And so we did have, very definitely, we got intelligence, we had effect. Now, one of the methods of distributing this was a bit unorthodox. And this happens, I suppose, at any army. Then the troops went down to Singapore, and they got a prostitute. The prostitute would very often, or they'd take a girl out, and the girl would say, the man would say, I've got no money, and she said, but if you give me a bandolier of ammunition or some Mills grenades, you can do what you like, you see. And so the payment was made in Mills grenades and bandoliers, you see what I mean, of thing. And this is how these explosive bullets and things were distributed. And it was very effective, but I don't know whether there was an accident in which a man was killed, or, you know, when I say an accident, whether it was he picked up something. But when the General Poet, who was Chief of Staff to Harding, came to hear about this, he put a stop to it.
For on what grounds?
Mainly that it might be used against our own troops. Now, halfway through this, I was told that the 21st SAS, with territorials, based near Paddington, near King's Cross, who had been administered by the artist rifles. They were the remains of the wartime SAS under Colonel Brian Franks. Well, they wanted to go to, I understand, wanted to go to Korea, but I had asked General Harding if I could get hold of a squadron to join me. And so they sent out to me. But the very young squadron commander, I won't mention his name, I forget it now, he thought he'd come out to replace me. And there was some awkward times when he objected to his troops being used in the jungle. He wanted them to be used like they were in France, just to flip in, do a job, and fly out again. He didn't like this long-term doing, and he had a bad influence on my training and everything else. And it finally finished up with a confrontation in front of General Harding, with him accusing me of doing this, that, and the other, and I said, well, he was not, he just wanted to take my place. He was very young, and of course, and he was removed. Then there was another officer, Scott, and he was very, very keen and very good like that, but then he started to do things on his own, and again, there was a sort of confrontation, and I found out later that he'd had a, the only reason why he'd come to us, he'd been kicked out of two battalions already. And this is one of the difficulties of a special force, is you do get the throwouts. Now, sometimes the throwouts are very good, but sometimes they don't fit in, and this chap didn't fit in. He wouldn't... see, when you get a regiment from various other regiments, they've all got their own characteristics and also their own ways of doing things. I mean, the Scots like to don't celebrate Christmas, like to celebrate New Year, and this sort of thing occurs. Well, it occurred over Christmas. He insisted on celebrating New Year and not getting into the jungle when ordered. And so I had to get rid of him. Then Harding, I think, was the origin, by mistake, meaning well, of the next problem I had. I'm only mentioning these are problems. There were 12 French Foreign Legion. The Vietnam War had started against the French. And in the Straits of Malacca, they jumped over the side of their French troop ship and swam ashore. They didn't want to go and fight in Vietnam. Well, the British authority didn't know what to do with them, so they were sent to me and added to my problems. Now, they might have been very good people, but I hadn't time for them. I had two excellent policemen attached to me, but I couldn't always find jobs for them. But they were very good, very useful, and trained us very well. I mention all these because somehow I should have had a staff officer or something looking after me. What I said, I wanted somebody who'd operated in this way before, had only got one leg, so he couldn't go in himself, and he would take all the administration and all the problems off my shoulders so that I could get on with training and operating the men. Well, this is what I didn't have, and